Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, we're only days away from the biggest match in world football. Do you want to get your gloating in now to save us time on Thursday's show?
It's written in the stars that we're going to lose. Kieran. It is written in the stars. Every single WhatsApp group that I'm on is saying exactly the same thing. We will have 80% possession and you'll score from an own goal.
Well, it would have to be an own goal, Kieran, because we haven't had a shot on target in three games. And as you said, it's very nice to see our front three coming out in solidarity with Gary Lineker by not appearing on Match of the Day. Very good. How are you, Kieran?
All good. Just back from a very nice meal with the Baroness last night. So
just back from it.
Well, back for a few hours.
Oh, I was going to say, because it's...
And she had a cocktail which involved beetroot, which is far braver than I would ever hope to be.
Get out of here. Which part of Sussex do you live in again, remind me? speaking of Gary Lineker, Kieran, will there be any financial implications over the Lineker saga, over the disgraceful way I think he's been treated? Oddly enough, I got a message from him on Friday morning saying it's all blown over now, it's fine. So I wish I'd put some money on the fact that it hadn't blown over. But is it going to affect the broadcasting deal? Will there be financial implications for his contract?
Well, I think if we separate out the two issues, the BBC has a contract with the Premier League to show highlights. Right. And that has I believe that would have a maximum amount of minutes that the BBC are allowed to show,
right? Okay.
And you would imagine, as most broadcasters, they would want to extract the maximum they can, and Match of the Day is normally on for an hour and a half, isn't it? Last night was, you're recording this on Sunday morning. Last night's show was about 20 minutes. I don't think there's a minimum amount of disclosure, so I don't see how the Premier League can pursue the BBC for not having commentary and not having punditry. I suspect to a certain degree that the BBC will have had quite high ratings for the show, perhaps not bigger than normal because of the curiosity factor. You know, what exactly were they getting? And then people will go onto social media and depending upon their viewpoint of the matter, they'll either say, oh, it's even better because there's no pundits and no commentators, or... I don't know why I said it in that voice. I don't know what came over me. Or they'll say, well, actually, the contribution which is made by the professionals in the industry does add something to the experience of watching highlights. And they'll be able to reach an appropriate informed conclusion. As far as Gary Lineker's contract is concerned, I think if the BBC try to claim that his activities in highlighting a human rights issue is a breach of contract and is gross misconduct, they would be in fairly shaky position. And I would imagine loads of lefty lawyers, I think all lawyers, apparently, according to the Prime Minister, are lefty lawyers. I think there would be a number of lefty lawyers who would be willing to represent Gary Lineker in taking the BBC to court over breach of contract, unless, of course, the two parties decide to come together to reach a mutual parting of the ways. But Gary Lineker is a very accomplished presenter and broadcaster. Mm. You and I both know how much Gary Neville and Thierry Henry and some of the people that get from Sky. I would imagine that other broadcasters would be willing to pay him a multiple of what he's paid before by the BBC.
Yeah, you know what they need, Kieran, Gary Lineker and the BBC? They need an independent regulator. That's what they need. let's get that out of the way. I don't know how long Match of the Day is at the moment, Kieran, because as you know, I only watch it when Palace win, so it's been a while. It could be. There certainly used to be a minimum. When I did Match of the Day 2 back in those days, there was a minimum of a minute and a half of each game. Right. At least a minute and a half had to be shown of each game, and I believe you're right. I believe there is a maximum amount they can show as well. Enough of that, Kieran. It's questions day today. I was trying not to say day twice there, which is strange considering it's my name. But it's the usual selection of interesting questions, which I'm looking forward to hearing asked. And the first one comes from me, and it's, why would anyone have a cocktail with beetroot in it, Kieran? What the? Seriously, I mean, that's going to be coming back in two ways, both physically and I'm going to keep mentioning it. What was it? Just like a slice of beetroot in the glass?
No, it was beetroot. I think there was some egg white involved and various bits of alcohol, which, as you know, go completely above my head. But she absolutely loved it to bits.
I imagine she liked the fifth one even more than the first one.
Judging from what she was singing on the way home on the train, I'm inclined to agree with you.
What was she singing? Never mind what she was singing.
A medley of Take That's greatest hits.
Oh, my Lord. Did you move carriage?
I did, yes.
Our first question comes from Matthew Hall. Matthew says, my question is on players' contracted hours. We often hear of how much players earn per week, but are players contracted to work a set number of hours per day, week, or month? If so, would it differ for training, match days, or sponsor foundation engagements, or could they claim overtime? It's an interesting concept, Kieran.
Yes, I did contact one of our friends who is an agent, and he says that there is a clause with regards to hours, because if the player is playing midweek on a regular basis, then potentially they could be having to attend work 7 days a week. And I can imagine some fans would, and I won't return to my former accent, I'd imagine that some fans could be frothing at the mouth at the thought of this. But there would be a potential clause. I think it will be rarely invoked if the demands put on the player by the club did exceed a pre-agreed limit. And I think it's a fairly, from what the agent told me, it is fairly standard, because everybody's entitled to a day a week with the family and so on. But sometimes the demands of football are very intense.
Yeah, and I think people don't realise as well, there are other things that footballers are asked to do as well than train and play. There's all sorts of media commitments, marketing commitments. There's a lot of handshaking to be done and a lot of smiling that don't go to the eyes. So there are things that they will be contractually obliged to do, Kieran, won't they? School visits, that sort of stuff.
Yes, and that tends to go under the radar because community activities don't sell newspapers. And I'm not being critical of newspapers here, but they don't make for good headlines, whereas Kyle Walker's Willy does.
Oh, they're very high on the list of three words I weren't expecting to hear.
Well, three-word slogans is the way forward, isn't it?
Apparently so, yes. I would have expected to hear the Baroness use that sort of language last night, Kieran, yes, after a night on the beetroot. You could have tried the beetroot and egg white bit.
Yeah, I don't like beetroot, and I've not eaten eggs since I was in the Hare Krishna movement back in the 80s.
Ah, lordy, really? We'll explore that. We've got a lot of questions to get through, Kieran. We'll explore that on the next live show, shall we? Our next question comes from Ivan Noel. Hello, Ivan. And Ivan said, with it being said that the gap between League Two and the National League is closing, could the EFL pull the plug on parachute payments between the two divisions? Would this decision need to be voted on by the League Two clubs? And if that is the case, then surely they will be continued to enforce, even if not required. Now, you will have an answer to this question, Kieran, but it turns out that in just a few days' time, we'll be able to ask this to somebody who really would know the answer.
It is, yes. my understanding, and I've spoken to some chief executives and directors of clubs that have been relegated from the EFL to the National League. And for people not familiar with the rule, is that you are entitled to, for two seasons, half of the League Two EFL money in terms of the broadcasting rights. But you're not entitled to the money which comes from the Premier League in what's referred to as solidarity payments. And the solidarity payments from the Premier League are actually generate more money than the EFL's own TV deal. The noises I got was that without these parachute payments, the clubs which are already, you know, they tend to be operating on very, very tight margins anyway, given the lower echelons of League Two, they would genuinely struggle to survive. And remember, there's this sort of this argument with regards to parachute payments. They should be a parachute and not a trampoline. Yeah. And I think in terms of the amount of money that's given, and B, the period of which money is given, I think they've probably got the numbers about right. But the EFL clubs could pull the plug, but then as Ivan rightly points out, that decision would have to be voted on by League Two clubs. They do that in order to protect themselves, because they know that two are going to be relegated. I think there's an increasing viewpoint that as the National League has effectively become Division 5 of the national game, given that the majority of clubs are full-time, and also given the fact that some of the clubs are attracting five-figure attendances on quite a regular basis, that there's a good case for going three up, three down, and therefore some greater form of financial support. But if you drop out, the money from the two payments is worth over £1 million a year. That could be easily a good third of your budget. And without it, there would be a danger that clubs could go out of business as a result of the change. Although I'm sure that players will either be out of contract, because you tend to get 1 or 2 year contracts only in League Two, or they would have to have clauses in their contracts which would necessitate significant pay cuts on what is already not necessarily a particularly generous pay scheme. So they are there out of a decision which had been actively made by EFL clubs, which is ironic given that the EFL seems to want them to be abolished between the Premier League and the EFL. And I've said on many occasions, I think that they are too high. They should be reduced but not abolished. And trying to get the right figure is, how long is a piece of string? Could they be enforced even if not required? I've got to be honest, Ivan, that they are required. If you've just had the trauma of losing your status in the 92 and all that brings, you are part of the EFL TV deal. It's not generous towards clubs in that division. They only get 8% of the total, so they get a tenth of what the clubs in the Championship are generating. But it's a classic case of every little helps, and the club's just gone through a fairly seismic shock in losing its residence in League Two. Another case for having three up and three down, because it allows those clubs to come back that much quicker.
It does seem quite difficult for those clubs to bounce back, doesn't it, from that particular league? It's a very interesting answer, Kieran, but it, yet again, proof of why we weren't asked to present Match Today last night, because I set you up at the start, Kieran, with a golden opportunity to say, well, funnily enough, we are talking to the head of the National League in just a couple of days' time, and you ignored it completely. You just went straight into all facts and numbers and all that sort of stuff. But it is a question, Kieran, that we can put to the head of the National League, who we are interviewing in a few days' time, are we not?
We are indeed, yes. Really looking forward to that. Now, we've got a long list of questions. But we won't be Paxman, because we're cuddly.
We are cuddly, yes. So did you have the orange robe and all that stuff and go up and down Oxford Street?
It was in Manchester. I was trying to gain the affections of a young lady. it's a very long story, and I didn't get very far, and I gave up eating it. Well, I was never keen on eggs to begin with, but now I've never eaten an egg since.
Yes, I'm going to point out, Kieran, there is an Oxford Street in in Manchester.
That's right. Yes, true. Yeah. Yes.
And I'm going to pretend that I knew that when I asked you the question. Nick Brace has an interesting one. Nick Brace says, charity football matches like Soccer Aid, raising money for worthy causes, seem to be more popular each year. With the stadiums being used, who bears the cost for their use? Is it a simple fee for renting them out, or do the charities organise the match, come to some sort of agreement to use it for free, which gets free publicity for the club?
Well, it would very much vary on a case-by-case basis. Soccer Aid is normally held at Old Trafford.
Yeah.
Manchester United and the Glazers come in for an awful lot of criticism for certain issues. But I don't think that this is one. I mean, I think the cost of stewarding would have to be borne by the charity. But I'm sure Manchester United, who do an awful lot of good. And you know, I think again, separate club from owners. I know people at Manchester United who were really fantastic during lockdown. We've praised Manchester United as well for agreeing to pay the real living wage to all of their staff. Yeah, something we campaigned for, and they have gone along with that. So there are people with a good moral compass there. With regards to something like this, I'm sure that they've done the appropriate thing and said, look, you're going to have to go and pay for stewarding. We're not going to incur extra costs, but with regards to the use of the ground, we're not going to charge you a fee. Clubs would normally, if there was an exhibition match on a corporate level, or if you wanted to hire out things for a corporate function, of course you'd have to pay. But in respect of this, I don't think that is the case.
Jamie Wheaton has our next question, and it's a subject that's becoming increasingly of interest to many football fans, I think. And Jamie says, I've recently been reading about the overlap of environmental and financial sustainability of football clubs, looking in particular at how moving to more environmentally friendly options, for example, solar power for floodlights, may improve their financial outlook. My club, Plymouth Argyle, and we are coming to Plymouth. We're going to get there eventually. But yes. My club, Plymouth Argyle, for example, have installed more solar panels at Home Park as part of their long-term sustainability goals. However, the movement to more environmentally sustainable procurement, and thus hopefully improved financial sustainability, is often unreachable to smaller clubs due to capital expenditure requirements. The EFL has launched the Green Code Initiative to help reduce clubs' footprints, but are there any club-led initiatives to promote the long-term financial benefits alongside the environmental impact within the EFL and on a local level, for example, amateur and non-league clubs, which is a long way round, basically saying that if clubs get their act in order, Kieran, they won't only be helping the environment, they can actually financially be helping themselves.
Yeah, yes. And I think we had Dale Vince from Forest Green Rovers on the show some time ago. FGR are moving to an all-wooden stadium. They are looking to increase their sustainability. I think there are certainly opportunities. You know, football, and whilst it might upset the groundsman, you can have undersoil heat generation and things like that. I know that at Brighton, we've moved to recyclable cups, and in terms of plastics and so on. And I think clubs are on a bit by bit basis are trying to do more and more. Even at university, we now have in some of the toilets, we use recycled rainwater when we have signs that the water won't be as clean as won't be as pure as perhaps you'd expect it to be. But actually, why are we using clean water for toiletry functions? So clubs, I think, will be moving to this because there are cost savings and as carbon fuels are decreasing in terms of volume, prices are rising. We've got obviously geopolitical issues as well to come into the fore, which has added to further increases as far as gas and electricity prices are concerned. It simply makes sense. Football clubs have big property footprints. Those can be used for positive methods, especially without wanting to fall into stereotypes. Yeah, Plymouth's on the south coast, so therefore it's going to get potentially more sunshine than clubs elsewhere. So you do a cost benefit exercise. You work out what's referred to as a payback period, and then make a decision as to whether or not individual cost-saving measures can go ahead. And this can apply to the amateur game as well. So it is something which clubs are looking at. I live not too far from Lewis, and I go to watch Lewis on occasions when and I'm not watching Brighton, and they've got a sustainability garden. They've got an organic garden just off the ground itself. And we went there a few weeks ago, myself and the Baroness. And this was quite a surprise when the player of the match was awarded with a bunch of organic spring onions for his performance.
Just remind me what county this is again, Kieran.
The good old Sussex by the sea, of course.
Any beetroot in the garden?
Well, I should have looked at the time, yeah. Actually.
I quite like beetroot, I have to say. There's a golden beetroot variety. It's very nice. I'm going to point out, Kieran, that you know how geographically precise and indeed geographically tetchy some of our listeners are. So you're going to get tweets for saying that Plymouth is on the south coast because it sort of technically is, but you're on the south coast, really. Plymouth's the southwest. They're touchy about these sort of things. So let's get to another country as quickly as possible. Mark Cole has our next question. Mark Cole is a friend of the show, has been listening right from the start. And Mark raises, I think, a very interesting question. Mark Cole says the 2022 World Cup in Qatar was moved, partially due to concerns about the weather there during the usual World Cup window. I couldn't help but notice, though, that temperatures in much of the United States, co-host of the 2026 World Cup, were higher this summer than they were in Qatar. We've always been told the Winter World Cup in 2022 is a one-off, but what if it isn't? What would be the potential economic costs if there were to be another November-December tournament in 2026?
I think this is a very valid point that Mark has raised, and indeed we've just seen this week a report has come out from FIFPro, which is the global trade union of footballers. And in that report, the members were asked how did they feel about a Winter World Cup, because there's an awful lot of people with opinions in football, but the actual people who play the game themselves, they do get very much sidelined. Yeah. And I think we are aware that some clubs and some players, upon returning from the World Cup, aren't returning with the normal level of spring in their step that would perhaps anticipate, because it was a demanding tournament and you got out of the routine, and we've even seen people like Pep Guardiola say that Calvin Phillips was overweight when he came back, and he wasn't monitored in the same way that they would have done at Manchester City. So I think there are some significant repercussions here. I think he also raises a very good point with regards to the weather in the next tournament, because it's scheduled for Canada, the USA, and Mexico. I'm sure all Irish fans remember the 1994 World Cup, and for anybody that's been grown up in Ireland, the sun doesn't shine there that often. It's the grass is green mainly due to the rain, the Irish complexion is not geared towards 30 plus degree heat, but a lot of the matches did take place you saw Jack Charlton not looking at his best either, given the weather involved. So this is an issue which appears to be completely bypassed. I think there are reasons for that which go beyond our geographical and weather-based knowledge and meteorological knowledge here, and far more to do with the fact that everybody bought into the idea of the World Cup in the USA being a good thing, regardless of everything, and the World Cup in Qatar being a bad thing, full stop. And perhaps things should be a little bit more nuanced. In terms of a November-December tournament in 2026, that is not going to be the case. But I think that there is probably a 50-50 chance of a November-December tournament taking place in 2030 if it is awarded to Saudi Arabia, because China was at one point looking to host the 2030 World Cup. I think the Chinese authorities now feel that perhaps it's still a cycle, at least too early for them to do that. They, if they are going to appear, they want to make an impact. So there is talk now about, I think, Saudi Arabia, Greece, and Egypt putting in a joint bid. And in which case you then have to consider what would the weather implications be, and we could move to another winter tournament. And once again, the decision will be made without any regard to the interests of players.
I think the abiding memory for many people, Kieran, of that 1994 World Cup is FIFA officials preventing water being allowed onto the pitch for players that were clearly suffering in the heat. It's an interesting one. I don't think anybody wants to get used to a November-December tournament, but there are parts of the world that deserve the World Cup as much as other parts of the world. And if that's the payoff for the World Cup going there, then so be it.
Yes, yes. You know, and Australia have applied historically as well.
Yeah, of course.
You can see the rationale. What we want to see is good football. Now, the best football is not played in 30-degree heat.
That's true. Certainly wasn't 30-degree heat yesterday at Selhurst Park, but there you are.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Kieran Fulop. I like the sound of Kieran Fulop, because Kieran starts his question by saying, whilst idly looking over the recent transfers, that's the sort of way you'd expect Oscar Wilde to ask a question. I was idly looking over the recent transfers. And there was one in particular that caught my eye. Is Finley coming in or going out? He seems to be not.
The Baroness is upstairs.
Oh, I see. I bet she is. She'll be upstairs.
Talking about Oscar Wilde, she's sort of with a handkerchief mopping her brow.
Anyway, Kieran Fulop, one of these transfers particularly caught his eye, and it was the Portuguese winger Francisco Trincão, who spent the season before last on loan at Wolves, then decided against taking up the option to make his move from Barcelona permanent. However, Wolves somehow managed to negotiate a sell-on clause of 20% for any future transfer of the player. Is this the first time a club has negotiated a sell-on clause for a player they don't own? And why would Barcelona agree to such a clause?
Well, I think this is an absolutely cracking piece of forensic and detective work by Kieran.
Yeah. Well, considering he's only idly looking over the thing. If he gets his arse in gear and does it properly, there's a job out there for him, isn't there?
The nature of contracts is that all clauses are valid if agreed by both parties. I suspect that that Barcelona were expecting him to move on and therefore signed the contract without either A, they didn't look at the small print, or B, they thought that the chances of him not joining Wolves on a full-time basis were so remote that it wouldn't have been an issue. So fair play to Wolves that they've effectively said that we might have had an option to buy, or the player had an option to join. Given that we've been involved in the development of the player, we therefore think that we should share in any benefits from his development. So I've not seen this clause before. I'm sure some of our agent friends will be in touch if they are more common than perhaps we realised. But I just think it's a smart piece of work by Wolves. And I think without wanting to be too much of a conspiracy theorist, it has been observed that perhaps Wolves are what we sometimes refer to as an agent-led club. So perhaps the agent here has done something very smart.
yeah, or has been smart enough to realise that the way things are at Barcelona at the moment, no one seems to be reading the big print, or the small print. Barcelona could do with getting you in. They'd probably pay you about 20 million quid a week that they can't, that they don't have as well. Andrew Cairns has our pre-penultimate question. And Andrew says, when a transfer is agreed between two clubs in countries who use different currencies, do changes in exchange rates affect the instalment payments or add-ons? Or is it an agreed fixed value at the time of the purchase? Or I would add, do they do it in a currency that they both agree on, like US dollars?
That wouldn't normally be the case because right. The vast majority of international transfers tend to be European-based. And therefore, potentially, you could lose out twice in terms of having to go and pay two exchange fees. But if it's from South America to Europe, then you could be using the US dollar as the selling currency, given the volatility of South American currencies. Again, I don't want to go and drop into stereotypes there, but I remember when I was in Peru, where inflation was a daily rate rather than an annual rate, and we were there in Lima when there was a military coup, and prices went up by 400% in a day, which was fine for us because we mainly had dollars, but the Peruvian inti at the time was a joke currency, and it was the local people who were really suffering. But when it comes to an international transfer, clearly there is a potential exchange gain or loss. The vast majority of transfers would be arranged in the currency of the selling club. In order to protect themselves, they want a guaranteed. So if a European club is selling to the Premier League, the deal would be quoted for in euro, and that's why we often see when players are coming from Europe to the Premier League, you will see Haaland's transfer was, I think it was, 51.6 million pounds. Yeah, well, it's a strange offer. But if you don't offer that, you'd have actually offered 60 million euro, or 60 million euro would have been the buyout clause. Certainly, if we take a look at Spanish football, I think we mentioned this on a recent show, what happens there is that the player has a buyout clause in the contract. And clearly that would be stated in euro, given that's the local currency as far as Spain is concerned. And then what would happen was that the player would be compensated if he was coming to the Premier League with that equivalent number of euro as far as the buyout is concerned. So some clubs do hedge with regards to currencies, and you see hedging gains and losses. And a hedge is where if you know that let's say that we sign a player from Spain or Portugal and the cost is 100 million euro and you're paying that in four installments, what you can do is that you can go to the market and you say, well, I know I need to pay 25 million euro in 1 year, 2 years and 3 years time, and you actually get a contract to buy euros at a fixed rate, and that gives you a degree of protection with regards to any gains and losses, because you end up paying more on the football contract. You actually made an equivalent profit in terms of your hedge contract. So given the numbers involved, we are seeing more sophisticated means of exchange rate protection being used at the upper ends of football.
I was rather hoping, Kieran, that when you said, I don't want to talk about Peruvian national stereotypes, you were going to go on and tell us that all the bears wore duffel coats. you had to mention, I don't know why you had to mention, you could have chosen any player other than Haaland. You had to drop that.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
You would have been pleased, Kieran. Two things happened yesterday in the Porson's Arms before the game that brought a tear to the eye of any accountant who spends a lot of time in Manchester. The first was that there were a group of older fans that nobody recognised, who turned out to be slightly hesitant, nervous Man City fans who didn't know whether they were in the right pub, that we got chatting to, who were just the nicest blokes you could meet, really proper, broad Manchester accents, which was lovely. So it's really nice to when two groups of fans could just meet. But at one stage, Kieran, before we were talking to them, several people around the table talking about Palace's latest financial figures were throwing the words like EBITDA All right. I just thought,
what have we done?
I just thought, what have we done? Literally, I said, boys, the game's gone. What's happening? What are we talking about, EBIT? And then, of course, I had to remind myself what EBIT, I had to furtively Google what EBITDA was because I'd forgotten what you told me about it. But yes, we've unleashed something terrible here, Gareth. I think both of us should go back to the Hare Krishna movement, or one of us should go back to it. Our penultimate question, Kieran, it comes from James Boll. James, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's B-O-E-E. So it could be James Boll. I don't know. But it's a question, Kieran, football fans simply can't get their heads around the whole thing about football kits. I think kits is the thing that fans are more obsessed about, even than amortisation. Mm. But James says... nobody used the word amortization. I was reading a really interesting thing the other day about Shakespeare in the year 1606, that nobody ever used the word equivocation until Shakespeare came along and obviously heard it in a pub somewhere and thought, this is a good word, and used it a lot. And nobody used the word amortization. I don't believe anybody before any football game ever, until 3 years ago, used the word amortization.
I'm so sorry.
But apart from amortization, it's kits and the economics of kits. James says Oxford United released their lovely home kit for the season in the summer, made by Macron for the first time, retailing at the nice round figure of £50, which is nice because most of the people wearing it have got a nice round figure as well. I've been quoting your previous episode about shirt sales, where you said the club would probably get £6 to £8 of this fee, the rest going to the manufacturer to cover design, manufacturer, distribution, marketing, and margin, etc. Someone asked me a great question, though, which is, how does this money get paid? Do the club have to buy a job lot at, say, £42 per shirt, then keep the profit and bear the loss of unsold shirts? Or do they get them for free in advance and have to transfer a fee to Macron per shirt sold, along with unsold shirts?
This very much varies from club to club and deal to deal. So I was talking to somebody with regards to Macron, and they said, well, you might get, you know, £250,000 worth of kit up front and, say, about £150,000 worth of kit for the first team. But is it a bespoke shirt? Is it effectively an off-the-peg shirt in which you've got a club badge? That would have an impact upon the position of the manufacturer. And the danger is that because quite a few of the manufacturers only want to have one or two production runs, you either have to run the risk of putting in a large order at the start of the season and being left with stuff you have to sell off cheap. And if you take a look at the websites of all clubs at this time of year, you know, even the likes of Manchester United are selling off this year's kit cheap compared to the launch price, because they know that they have to get it off the racks by June, because that's when they start to gear up for the new shirts for the next season. So it's very much a balancing act. And if you're getting a bespoke shirt, you know, I was told that on a £50 shirt sale, you'd probably pay £22 if the manufacturer wasn't giving you an upfront fee. So it does depend. You know, if we compare Manchester United to Liverpool, for example, Manchester United get a guaranteed £75 million from Adidas and a small commission per shirt. So Adidas make all of the margin, whereas Liverpool have got a £30 million deal with Nike, but Liverpool get 20% plus of the sale price of the shirt. So it is something which is far more nuanced and far more complex, and it's spreadsheet heaven as well in terms of the deals that are placed before the chief executive, and this is why a little bit of Excel can go a long way. And you know, there's quite often a problem that you can't just place an order for, you know, well, we think we might sell another 200, so order 200, because there will often be minimum order quantities as well. Yeah, you know, we've got the problem at Brighton that we've not had any home shirts to sell since before Christmas, which is a real shame given the huge influx of Japanese fans who come to every match now to watch Mitoma and then go to the club shop and you know, you've got a picture of Steve Foster from 1983 on a T-shirt, and the people are going, well, where's Mitoma gear? I mean, to be fair, they're trying to do something about it, but it is frustrating. So you can end up with significant stock losses. You can understand why the clubs don't want to do that, because who wants to buy last year's kit? Sometimes you'll outsource that, to the likes of Fanatics and so on. They take on that risk, which means that the club effectively has to pay a price for that. Kits are amazingly complex areas, as we're discovering more and more. You know, and we did have somebody from the distributors of Hummel, which on the show itself, and they subsequently went into administration. And that's caused issues for clubs like, I think, Coventry and Millwall and so on.
I quite like the image, Kieran, of some very excited young Japanese football fans getting home to their parents after a trip to Brighton, and their parents going, did you get your Brighton shirt, son or daughter? And them going, no, they didn't have any. They did get 2 kilo of beetroot.
Yes.
Paul Bentley has our last question, and this is a question. You talk about spreadsheet heaven, and I don't think it's our catchiest slogan so far, Kieran, is it? A little bit of Excel goes a long way.
No.
I can't imagine Classic FM, any of the adverts going, a little bit of that, never mind. But this is a question I think I was going to say you would enjoy researching, but I suspect, knowing you may have had the answer at the tip of your fingers anyway. Paul Bentley says, if a football club is run like a normal commercial business, where making profits is the aim, how much should a footballer get paid in each of the English leagues if a club wanted to make, say, a 10% profit margin?
Well, I did plug these figures into a spreadsheet or two, and what we find is that it very much varies from club to club. So if we take the Premier League as a start point, in order for Chelsea and Everton to achieve that profit margin, Chelsea would have to reduce the average wage by £68,000 a week. For Everton, it would be £60,000 a week. For Palace, Palace are actually run a reasonably tight ship. For Palace, it would only be £4,500 a week on. You know, Palace got average wage of, what, 54, 55. There would have only been three clubs, and these figures are from 2019, because I wanted to take out the distortion caused by lockdown and COVID on the numbers. Only three clubs would end up having to increase the wages in order to achieve that, and that would have been Wolves, Newcastle, under Mike Ashley. And when we said, for all of Mike Ashley's faults and his unpopularity with Newcastle, he actually left a legacy of a club that was in a very strong financial position. Newcastle could have paid an extra £11,000 a week, and they would have still made this 10% profit margin. And the good news for PIF and Amanda Staveley and the Rubin brothers, who've inherited at Newcastle, that's given them quite a lot of positive wiggle room when it comes to offering generous contracts to players, because Newcastle will be better. But as usual, the club that I've always said is the one that would win the most price of football trophies in terms of profitability would be Spurs. You could have given Harry Kane and co a £19,000 a week pay rise to all of the first team squad, and they'd still be making profits of 10% of their revenue, so profits of around about £40 million a year, and that's indicative of the nature of the way that the club has been run. It's always had very good control over its costs.
And did you bother going outside the Premier League, like Paul said? Could we mention the other leagues?
Yeah, in the Championship, is such a car crash that effectively the players would have to work for nothing.
Oh, okay.
We are talking. We are talking regular. The average wage in the Championship is around about £14,500 a week. You would have to reduce that to by two thirds on average.
Wow, crikey. Well, thank you for that question, Paul. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, I'm not talking to you specifically here, Paul, by the way. I realise that makes it sound like I'm asking Paul to make a small monthly contribution to the product, we're asking everybody, then you can do that by going to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, as always, folks, thank you very much for all the support and all the means through which you do it, of which, of course, Patreon is one, and we appreciate that you're being very kind and generous, and it is appreciated very much. There are a variety of ways in which you can support the show, and one of which is to go onto your app and to give us a review. It helps us in the charts. It helps us in terms of also providing feedback and having credibility when we're trying to book guests and everything. We don't quite understand how it works, but it does have an impact upon the algorithm in terms of the review. But by all accounts, the narrative that you put on the review is less of an issue. So you could say you'd rather have the show presented by absolutely nobody in solidarity with Match of the Day and Gary Lineker, and it wouldn't make a blind bit of difference to us.
I don't think it would make much difference to Gary either. Really.
To be fair,
of all the people that have been supporting him, he gets a whole long list, and at the bottom with Kieran Maguire and Kevin Day. That's nice. Thanks, lads. there is also, you know how producer Guy's mind works, there's also the possibility that he's desperately scrambling to get hold of Gary Lineker's agent as we speak, just to check whether Gary fancies hosting the pod for a couple of weeks, just to tide him over. I do hope that situation is resolved. Apparently, we're talking on Sunday, and apparently emergency talks will be taking place between the BBC and Gary Lineker today. I love the BBC, and I'm very fond of Gary. He's a top lad. So I hope it does get sorted out. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.